You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 7th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Mark Joseph Stern, Slate staff writer, Justice and the Courts, on the Supreme Court's assault on our democracy. Also on the program today, Brian Concannon, Executive Director at Project Blueprint, Advisor to the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, on the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. Meanwhile, in this country, the Delta variant, now the dominant strain of COVID. COVID is surging, meanwhile, in immigrant detention centers throughout the country. Biden to sign an executive order to encourage the Federal Trade Commission to ban or limit non-compete clauses. Could be a big deal. Monopsony drives down wages. In New York City, we have a winner in the Democratic mayoral primary, which is almost like saying we have a winner in the mayoral race, period. Eric Adams, likely to be New York's next mayor. The RNC was hacked allegedly by Russian hackers. Odd choice for Hillary Clinton to perpetrate that and promote that. But new data show uninsured get higher prices from hospitals. In the Senate and House, Warren and Rokana demand the Defense Department review its civilian casualty numbers from 2020. Nancy Pelosi's husband bought $5 million in Google stock, really, actually Alphabet, just as there are antitrust measures that are trying to be pushed through the House. CIA director makes a secret visit to Brazil to meet with the Bolsonaro government, as that government is under siege for its corruption. All this and more on today's program. I failed to say at the top of the show that we are not breaking format, adjusting format. We do that all the time. I mean, I guess it's our format's relatively loose here anyways. But in the fun half, the second half of the program today, at least in the first hour of the fun half, I will be hosting Yaron Brook. He is the, my understanding is that he is the current chairman of the board at the Ayn Rand Institute. And he had reached out to a mutual friend, Ben Burgess. He wanted to debate me, I guess, in the wake of the Steven Crowder situation. And I said, of course. And so that's going to happen in the second hour. I'm not sure exactly what he wanted to debate me on. We didn't really get into the details, but I presume it's that he wants to argue that libertarianism is the best. Something other than what?
Something other than the motivated reasoning of oligarchy?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that's on the that was one of the first questions I was going to ask him was, is this not the reason, the motivated reasoning of the oligarchy? And then take it from there.
What is the over under on terms of minutes on when he will bring up cryptocurrency into the conversation?
Oh, I don't think he'll do that. I don't get that sense. He seems like an old school, although I don't know. But I mean, he's on the board of directors, Ayn Rand. So, but he may throw it in there. Like, I'll bet you an Ethereum coin or something like that.
You're like, sure, I'll take that bet on that completely made up currency.
You bet me a specific baseball card too. I might bite, frankly, if I know it has some value. Mm-hmm. So let's turn to this. You know, we're in the midst of a very strange period in our politics, very, very narrow. I mean, there's ongoing negotiations about the bipartisan infrastructure deal, ongoing intra-Democratic party negotiations, where a lot of people are finding themselves as the new Joe Manchin, because there's such a small margin where they're negotiating on the infrastructure deal that will happen under reconciliation. And the right, the conservatives, the Republicans seem to be barely engaging in this, what could be massive change in policy and have massive policy implications. And instead, they are obsessed and focused with the fictional notion that critical race studies is being played out, is being taught in elementary schools as a way of expressing anger that there has been a revisitation over the past 5 or 6 years, maybe more, maybe less, on questions like, hey, why do we have these monuments to literally a war that was fought on behalf of trying to maintain slavery? Why, why don't we teach things like Reconstruction? Why do grown adults in the United States have no awareness of the multiple massacres that took place in the years after Reconstruction as a way to diminish Black power and Black wealth?
Why do 8% of high school seniors not understand that slavery was the main cause of the Civil War, was the cause of the Civil War?
And all of these things are, you know, we're going through a period of looking back on our history and anticipating it. And there are cultural changes, and there's really no way to address that without sounding like you're being racist. So instead, you make up the idea that a legal theory that is taught in law schools is being taught in elementary schools. And you use it as a catch-all that can be expanded. You can also throw in communism and Marxism into it, and cultural Marxism.
And you get to, you know, make sure that the grassroots Republican base is engaged on like an incredibly micro level when it comes to their school board. And that gets them to engage in other types of conservative politics, helping the agenda. I mean, it's ingenious in many ways. They found their new cultural catch-all, as you say, in the right. Biden era.
Right. And they'll, you know, in 4 or 5 years, it'll be something completely different, I assure you. And also probably equally as based in race. But just like slightly more submerged. It won't be political correctness. It won't be cancel culture. It'll move into the next thing and whatnot. But the other aspect of that is that there is no Republican agenda. Reminder, the Republican platform, as irrelevant as these documents might be in the context of governing, although I don't think they're quite as irrelevant as some people think, they are at least a statement of the party's principles. You go back and you look like Texas Republican platform, always a lunacy. And if you go back like 10, 15 years, you can see that that lunacy has now been adopted by the rest of the Republican Party. This past year, it was nothing but we support Donald Trump, period, end of story. We don't have to do any, like no more writing, and the printing costs are down. And we can see that abject fealty on display on Fox News yesterday, J.D. Vance, the supposed more sort of like thoughtful conservative, sort of like populist conservative, like the one who understood the dynamic of what was happening, but was responsible and thoughtful. Well, now he's running for office. And so, of course, that all gets jettisoned. And what he has to do is go and take the knee and ask for the forgiveness of Donald Trump. This is like one of those like Jane Goodall videos where you see the gorillas holding out their hand to show their fealty. Here it is, J.D. Vance on Fox News.
You met with former President Trump earlier this year. It's a coveted endorsement in these primaries for sure. And as you know, there are reports out there that say that you have these deleted tweets that come from 2016 where you heavily criticized the president, that you were voting for somebody else. One, can you confirm for us that those were in fact your tweets and that you did in fact delete them? And if so, what's changed?
Sure. Well, like a lot of people, I criticized Trump back in 2016, and I'd ask folks not to judge me based on what I said in 2016, because I've been very open about the fact that I did say those critical things, and I regret them, and I regret being wrong about the guy. I think that he was a good president. I think he made a lot of good decisions for people, and I think he took a lot of flack. And as you probably appreciate, Alicia, you know, I've taken a lot of flack myself over the last few years for standing up for the president's voters, but also standing up for the agenda. And I think that's the most important thing is not what you said 5 years ago, but whether you're willing to stand up and take the heat and take the hits for actually defending the interests of the American people, because that's what this business of politics should be all about.
Are you concerned that this is going to become a gift to some of your primary challengers?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sure they'll use it against me. And of course, I think they have baggage of their own when it comes to President Trump and when it comes to other issues. But I think my advantage in this race is that we're talking and I'm talking about real issues. That's the most important thing.
Not to the Republican primary voter. It's not sad. Very, very sad. The bootlicker. Jesus.
The idea of taking the heat and taking the hits. Here's a question that I would ask. Well, then why did you delete them?
Yeah, somebody who takes the heat doesn't apologize. You just take the heat.
Well, but also, like, what were you hoping to do by deleting those tweets? I mean, if you're going to take the heat and take responsibility for the fact that you were in some way less than laudatory towards our dear leader, why did you delete them? Or another question would have been like, when did you have this change of heart?
Yeah, can I just read one of the tweets? In October 2016, Trump makes people I care about afraid, immigrants, Muslims, etc. Because of this, I find him reprehensible. Like, I'm curious about, like, does
what
were
changed?
You wrong then? Or was the fact that Trump was such a good president make it, you know, worth it that he scared those immigrants and Muslims?
Yeah, the over 600,000 dead might disagree with his assessment on his presidency, but...
I'm just curious as to what the good decisions he made were that were helpful to Muslims and to immigrants, or what the decisions, and at what point did J.D. see the light? I mean, that would be an interesting thing to examine. But there it is. If you want to understand what the modern Republican Party is about, and just to be clear, that's not authoritarianism.
No, right. But let me just quickly say, too, like, that's so perfect to say what the modern Republican Party is about, right? He bent the knee to Trump. He has to show that he expressed his adoration for Trump. And just a few, right, the Jane Goodall experience. But just years before when his book came out, Hillbilly Elegy, he was being heralded as the voice for the true red America that the New York Times and that liberals on the coast wanted to perceive red America as. So much like the Lincoln Project, these kinds of conservative voices were fetishized. They're very different. But they all come around. The Lincoln Project was a grift. They wasted all their money. They enriched themselves. They also had no effect on the election. And then J.D. Vance comes around and licks the boot of Trump. All of these facile notions that liberals create to make themselves feel better about who the Republicans are, what the Republican Party is, they always come crashing down eventually.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back, and we'll be talking to Mark Joseph Stern when we return. Hey, folks. 2 days in a row. I hope Harry's didn't think I was going to be shaving both days. But when I do shave, I shaved with Harry's. And now Harry's is offering our listeners their starter set at harrys.com/majority. Told you this before. Harry's delivers a close, comfortable shave, and they do it at a real, legit, fair price. As low as $2 per refill. Their blades are designed to stay sharp. They bought their own factory in Germany that's been making precision-engineered blades for over 100 years. Guys who shave four times a week said their eighth shave was as smooth as their first. And so for guys like me, who shave only twice a week, I get a blade, I'd make them last.
Oh, now it's twice a week, huh?
I know. I shave twice a week. Once at beginning, once towards the end. Sure. I'm not going to shave 2 days in a row, though. But when I do, it's with Harry's. Why? They've got a weighted ergonomic handle. They got their signature blade cartridge, narrow for my asymmetrical nostrils. It's a smart, simple razor designed for delivering a close shave all along the contours of your face. And they stand behind the quality of their blade so much that you get a 100% money-back guarantee on harrys.com. I love Harry's. They've been very supportive of this program, and they've been very supportive of my face. I'm not suggesting that the narrower blade head was made specifically for me, but it does work specifically for me. Harry's has given their best offer to Majority Report listeners. New Harry's customers can get a starter set at harrys.com/majority. You get a 5-blade razor, a weighted ergonomic handle, foaming shave gel, travel blade cover, a $13 value for just $3. There has never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/majority to redeem your offer today. Also, this is exciting. Summer's here. Great time to read. This summer is yours for the taking. If you've always wanted to read more, you can empower your inner reader with the Literati Book Club, where you read alongside the world's most inspiring authors and leaders. I've had a great experience with Literati for Saul. They have book clubs for kids, and now they have them for adults. You can join Malala or Stephon Curry or Richard Branson and more on their next reading adventure. Author, leaders, and activists, they spark lively conversations in 12 unique book clubs, and Literati delivers their monthly book picks straight to your door. That means you can talk to Stephon Curry about his favorite books with him, Emma.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I know.
So some fun pronunciations you had going on.
What? Is it not Stephon Curry?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming it's Steph Curry, right? Basketball player.
So. Yeah. It is Steph Curry. All right, fine, whatever. You find exclusive interviews. I mean, I know he's a great basketball player. Richard Branson, I said right, and I know he's the virgin.
Also, a great basketball player.
Not so much. Malala, not maybe she's a good basketball player. I don't think.
No, it was Malala. That's what you're talking about. Okay, just sorry. Keep going.
All book club members can shop the entire Literati library at discounts with many books over 50% off. And here's the best part. You can move freely between clubs, or you can use the standard membership to access everything and choose the books you want delivered. Reimagine what a book club can be. Redeem your free trial at literati.com/majority report. Head to literati.com/majority report to learn more and read more with Literati. literati.com/majority report. Check it out, folks. And lastly, people are looking to go out right now. Starting to get back to normal a little bit. Still got to be careful. The Delta variant's out there. But if you're vaccinated, the implications of that Delta variant, much, much less severe. But the bottom line, you're going to have people going out and seeing movies and going out to restaurants and going to see live music and, of course, going to the post office. What? Yeah, no, maybe you don't want to necessarily go to the post office, run some of those errands that you don't want to spend your time doing. Well, luckily with stamps.com, you know, you can skip those trips to the post office. Why? Because you can mail and ship anytime, anywhere, right from your computer. You can send letters, you can ship packages, you can pay less with discounted rates from the USPS, it's the United States Postal Service, and UPS. You can print official U.S. postage and shipping labels using a standard printer, and you can do this 24/7, 365. Stamps.com is saving nearly 1 million small business owners like you time and money. They've got a switch and save feature. You can compare carriers to find the best rates every single time. This was crucial back in the days when I was sending out, you know, DVDs and whatnot for membership, all that stuff way back in the day. Stop wasting time going to the post office. Go to stamps.com instead. There's no risk. With my promo code Majority Report, you get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. There's no long-term commitments. There's no long-term contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, type in Majority Report. That's stamps.com, promo code Majority Report, stamps.com. You will never have to leave your home again. But you want to, and you don't have to go to the post office. Want to welcome back to the program Mark Joseph Stern. He is the Slate staff writer, justice, who writes about the justice and the courts, here with Emma Vigeland. Mark, thank you so much for coming today.
Of course. Always a pleasure, Sam.
We spoke about less than a week ago, I think it was. And while we were talking, the court was just about announcing two rulings, which you were heavily anticipating. And I suspect that you thought they were going to be bad, and they were not great.
They were bad, yes.
And these are, I mean, genuine assaults on our democracy in a real structural way that are not acute, in the sense that, you know, people can argue that the insurrection was an assault on our democracy. This is something that is going to be durable and lasting, and I think get worse. Let's start with, I don't know which one you want to start with. It's either Brnovich versus the DNC or Americans for Prosperity versus Bonta. Which one, I don't know, which one's worse?
So I think if you take these two cases together, they stand for the proposition that the Supreme Court has made it easier to buy elections in secret and harder to vote in them. I think we should start with the voting case, Brnovich v. DNC, because Americans for Prosperity, it takes a little bit more explanation to sort of connect the dots. Brnovich is a straightforward attack on the Voting Rights Act, one that I think was widely misreported as being not so bad, but at least in my view, and in the view of a lot of voting rights experts, it is a really terrible decision that will have ramifications for years, if not decades, to come.
I mean, this is consistent with John Roberts. I mean, what's amazing about this is that to have a career where 30, 40 years ago, you can be telling the president of the United States, hey, we need to sink this Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And then 40 years later, to find yourself in the position of being literally one of five or six people in the world who couldn't unilaterally do it. I mean, this would be a really heartwarming story for John Roberts if it wasn't so horrific for our democracy.
Yes, that's correct. So just to kind of flesh out what you noted there, you know, back in 1982, John Roberts was a young idealistic foot soldier in the Reagan Revolution at the Justice Department, who was already very hostile to voting rights. And one of his main issues at the Justice Department was fighting an amendment to the Voting Rights Act that Congress was considering that would prohibit any voting restriction that results in the disproportionate disenfranchisement of racial minorities. And I think it's really important to zero in on this language, right? So the 15th Amendment passed after the Civil War bans intentional race discrimination in voting. So, you know, if Mississippi says Black people can't vote, that's unconstitutional. And in 1980, the Supreme Court had interpreted the Voting Rights Act to only encompass what the 15th Amendment encompasses, intentional race discrimination. The problem is that today, and back then too, very few legislators go onto the floor of the state house and say, I hate Black people and I don't want them to vote. And that's why I'm passing this voter suppression law. Voter suppression laws are dressed up in neutrality. And so Congress was responding to that bad decision in 1980 by banning laws that also result in a disparate impact on racial minorities' ability to vote, even if you can't prove that the goal, the intent, the aim was to suppress minorities' votes. That's what John Roberts hated back in 1982 and lobbied against. It did ultimately pass, but as you noted, 40 years later, John Roberts gets to be one of the six people who then turns around and essentially rewrites and dismantles this really important amendment to the Voting Rights Act, which was pretty much all we had left to stand in the way of the raft of voter suppression laws passed in the wake of 2020.
And we should say, one of the things that's a little bit ironic is we're having this massive fake debate over critical race studies right now. And the concept of something can be racist in result, even if there is no intent, never mind proving it. Even if there's no intent, there's no feeling of like, I'm a racist and I don't want Black people to vote. Or, you know, even if it's like, I'm a racist and I don't care whether Black people get the right to vote, if it helps me at the long run, it's the result. Like, you know, and so it's, you're preventing people from using proxies right, as a way of, you know, it's like saying, I want to, we're not targeting, Latino people, but we're only going to say people whose last name is, let's say, Ramirez, can't vote. Like, you know, you have a fairly good notion that like a high percentage of the people that you're, and that is this proxy notion, right, to fight that. So how did they attack the section two, even though it was explicit in the ratification in 1982?
So what Justice Alito did in his majority opinion was create all of these new factors that courts have to go through when assessing a Section 2 Voting Rights Act claim. And the factors are designed to ensure that almost any law will be upheld. And to explain why, let me just sort of walk you through the main points here. First of all, Alito says, well, if there was a law that was common in 1982, then it's probably legal today because that's the backdrop against which Congress passed this law. So that's the baseline for voting. Two big problems there. First of all, Congress passed this law in 1982 because it thought there was a lot of race discrimination in voting that was getting approved because plaintiffs couldn't prove discriminatory intent. So the idea itself totally contradicts the history of this law. The second problem relatedly is that back in 1982, early voting and absentee voting were nearly unheard of. They were severely restricted by almost every state. Almost everybody had to vote on election day. Absentee voting and early voting are relatively modern inventions, and widespread early voting and absentee voting are really pretty new as of the last decade or so. So what Alito has done is ensure that all of these attacks on the franchise that came after 2020, which take the form of cuts to early voting, cuts to absentee voting, really drastic restrictions on when and how people can vote, almost all of those laws will now be upheld because they weren't common in 1982. And so according to Alito, they're not the kind of thing that Congress wanted to ban.
Can you talk just really quickly? Can you talk about the appeals court or the appeal that in Arizona that led Alito to this decision, or essentially that he ignored? Because I think some of that context is really important to understanding the decision.
Absolutely. So the case specifically dealt with two laws passed by Republicans in Arizona. And I think I want to note that even though it's important to talk about this, and you're absolutely right that they're important for the context, at the end of the day, this case is about so much more than just these two laws, right? But Arizona Republicans passed a ban on ballot collection by third parties, which just means family members or community leaders used to go around in Arizona and collect people's ballots and turn them over to election officials. Zero proof of any fraud resulting from this practice. And one of the reasons it was so popular is that Arizona has a lot of indigenous people. There are a lot of people who live in tribal reservations where there is severely limited access to the postal service. There's no postal offices. There's not even regular mail. And there, an individual might have to drive for hours to get to the nearest precinct or post office. So a lot of community elders would gather ballots from people and drive and do the work and turn them over en masse to election officials. Arizona Republicans banned that, understanding well that the vast majority of indigenous voters are Democrats. Similarly, Arizona decided to invalidate all ballots that are cast out of precinct. So in some Arizona counties, you have to go to this specific precinct to vote. If you go to the wrong precinct, you might still get the right ballot. You might be voting in almost all, if not all, of the correct races, but Arizona will invalidate your ballot altogether. And for reasons that remain very mysterious, precincts for Hispanic and Black communities tend to be much farther away than precincts in white communities. In fact, Hispanic voters in Arizona would sometimes have to drive past precincts for white communities to get to the ones assigned to them. And so understandably, this law had a wildly disproportionate impact on Hispanic voters whose ballots were disregarded because of this rule, exponentially more frequently than white people's ballots. And so the Court of Appeals in this case looked at those laws and said, hey, you know, we can't necessarily prove that they're passed with discriminatory intent, although they did think that the ballot collection ban was passed with racist intent. But the court said either way, this has a disparate impact on racial minorities, and so it violates the Voting Rights Act. And that is the decision that the Supreme Court by a 6-3 vote overturned, saying, in fact, both of these laws are absolutely hunky-dory.
What a mystery as to why those voting places would be so far away from the actual voters. And just to be clear on what you had said earlier about Alito and saying with that 1982 thing, I want people to understand this is the functional equivalent of a plumber coming in to fix a leak and the leak still being there after the plumber's gone. He goes, well, that was the baseline. The leak existed there. Like, you know, my coming here and fixing it, you should not judge it against anything other than what it was in the first place, right? Like, I mean, Section 2 was updated because of the laws that existed at the time, not as an acceptance of the laws at the time. Why else would you have Section 2?
Right. And you know, we should just be clear that there's nothing in the text of this law that supports Alito's reading. You know, for a court of ostensible textualists, this is just riffing. And Justice Kagan, in her dissent, calls Alito's opinion a law-free zone. And I think that's exactly right. And I'll give you another example, a factor that Alito introduces here. He says that if the state decides to restrict or even ban a certain method of voting. So say a state decides to ban all early voting across the board. That's not necessarily illegal as long as people have another method of voting that's available to them. So if it's still easy to vote, if they can still go on election day in person and vote, if there are other opportunities, then this ban or restriction on one particular method isn't illegal, even if it's the method that is disproportionately favored by a specific racial minority. And by banning it, you are placing a disproportionate burden on those individuals' ability to cast a ballot.
And lastly, because I want to move on to the other case, but he also sort of questioned the concept on some level of racial disparity, didn't he? Or watered it down by implying that, like, there's a lot of other things that you could blame on this disparity.
Right. So Alito questions the existence, really, of racially disparate impacts altogether. He doesn't accept this concept of racially disparate impacts. He thinks that it's kind of an offensive idea. This is something Clarence Thomas has railed against as well. I don't think he has the votes to totally obliterate it as a concept, but what he says is, well, you know, if there's just small differences, if, you know, 98% of people can still vote, and most of those individuals are not having issue casting a ballot, then, you know, we're not going to step in and we're not going to let the federal courts step in. The problem with that kind of reasoning is that it may be that the entire 2% of people who can't vote may be racial minorities. It may be that you have restricted all of the ways that racial minorities prefer to vote. And so, yes, it may only affect 2% of the population, but that is more than enough to swing an election. And if it's a disparate impact on racial minorities, we know which way it's going to swing the election. So really an attack on the kind of foundational idea that Congress had when amending this law in 1982, questioning the idea that evidence of hugely disparate impacts on minorities counts for anything when you're suing under the VRA.
Well, maybe Stephen Breyer's abject narcissism will provide him the seventh vote that he needs for that. All right, let's talk about the Americans for Prosperity versus Bonta. This, the words of Anthony Kennedy in Citizens United echo in my head over and over again. Well, it's something to the effect of, at least we have disclosure. You know, if we didn't have disclosure, there would be a problem with this corporate money. But, and here we are.
Yes. So this is a case about donor disclosures in California, specifically people who give a ton of money to charities, including partisan political charities. So the plaintiff here is Americans for Prosperity, which is a Koch-run charity, right? But they're registered as a nonprofit in California. California passed this law that requires charities to turn over the names of their very high-dollar donors to the state attorney general. The state attorney general uses that information to prevent charitable fraud. A quarter of all charities are located in California in this country. Charitable fraud is a real and serious problem, and it often takes the form of charities promising donors one thing and then doing something totally different with their money. So the idea here was, well, the attorney general is going to follow up with donors, make sure that the money is actually being used for what it's been promised for. The Supreme Court strikes down that entire law on its face, not just as applied to charities that face serious threats of retaliation to their donors, but every single charity, and says this violates the First Amendment freedom of association, which, by the way, is not really in the First Amendment. It's a sort of penumbra you have to find. If you gaze deeply into the First Amendment, you can extract this freedom of association. The Chief Justice said people will be too scared to give money because they don't want their names turned over to the California Attorney General. People will decline to associate with these organizations. So the court has to subject any kind of disclosure law to something that looks a lot like strict scrutiny, really heightened, intense judicial scrutiny. And Roberts, in his majority opinion, said this law doesn't pass it because basically there's no evidence that California is going to use the information correctly. And the law is not sufficiently tailored to address the needs that the state has put forward, which, to translate all that, as Sotomayor put it in dissent, the court has put a huge bullseye on all disclosure laws, specifically including election and campaign finance disclosure laws, which is what this case is really about if you read between the lines.
How can they? Well, so what is the standard for the strict scrutiny as it's applied here? And how can they say it doesn't reach that, it doesn't pass that threshold, considering that was almost like the leverage point for allowing unlimited corporate donations in the first place?
Right, exactly. That was the theory behind Citizens United. And the court upheld disclosures there by an 8-1 vote and said, don't worry, we're all good with disclosure laws. But here, the court turns around and jacks up the standard. And what's key, the move here to understand, is that the court says, any kind of disclosure law has to be subject to narrow tailoring. So it has to be as narrowly tailored as possible to satisfy the government's important interests in whatever it's trying to achieve. Narrow tailoring is a really strict test because you can always fly spec the government's justification for a law and say, well, you could have made this even narrower. You know, you could have excluded more groups. You could have set a higher threshold. You could have done all this stuff that you didn't do. And so we don't think this satisfies strict scrutiny. And that is a new rule because in the old days, it used to be that you would only get to that level of scrutiny if the individual fighting the disclosure rule had proved that they were facing actual harm, that people were harassing them for their free association, that people were threatening them with violence. Only then could you get a foot in the door. What Roberts did is get rid of that threshold requirement that you prove you're actually facing retaliation or harassment and say anyone who doesn't want to disclose information to the government, all you have to do is raise a challenge to a law on its face, say it's not narrowly tailored, and in short, you will win.
I mean, this seems to just, it seems to have potential implications even beyond the disclosures that come with contributing to political organizations, to political, I mean, like the government requires some information from you that ends up being, you know, somewhat public, right? I mean, like this seems to, in some ways, again, another assault on sort of government's ability to regulate.
Absolutely.
Just another direction.
Absolutely. So you can imagine, say, a business telling the government, we don't want to turn over our worker pay. We don't want to disclose that information to you because we think we'll leak it. And other businesses will seize upon it to either provide more competitive pay or cut costs or whatever. And as soon as a business raises that challenge, in theory, the government's going to have to prove that this regular, boring, vanilla regulation that's probably been on the books for decades satisfies this super strict standard of review. But I do think that right now, what Roberts is setting his sights on are these campaign finance laws that require disclosure of people who've donated money to a candidate or a campaign, because this opinion really just tees up a future decision where the court will say, you know, we don't think that a requirement of disclosures for donors who gave over $1,000 satisfies this heightened scrutiny, because $1,000 isn't that much. And the government hasn't proven that $1,000 can corrupt any candidate. And without that evidence, we're going to strike this down. The next case, $5,000, the next case, $25,000. At some point, the court basically just rules out the possibility of disclosure laws altogether.
And I mean, and I know this is tangential, but you know, the way they work is they're teeing up stuff that may be reversed, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the road. Like in New York City, I imagine they have it in other places. You know, the Board of Health gives a grade on how clean your restaurant is. I mean, it seems to me like, well, you disclose that to the public, it could hurt our business. I mean, it's one thing for the Board of Health to come in and say, here's a grade, you've got to raise it. But I mean, do you really need to tell the public?
Right. And one thing that's important to note here, and we talked about this in the context of Cedar Point, the union case, right? It's not just about these particular facts, and it's not just about precisely what's required and what's not. It's about making regulation so burdensome and so expensive for the government that the government just gives up. The government does not have an army of lawyers like many of these businesses and politicians who are willing to defend their interests for, you know, ever. The government doesn't have an endless army of lobbyists or an endless amount of resources to fight this battle. It is a David versus Goliath kind of battle. And at the end of the day, I think your example is a good one. There's a good chance that the government will just give up rather than trying to protect these disclosure rules. And that is maybe what I'm most afraid of here, not just that the government will keep losing in court, but that the government will stop trying because it can't afford to keep fighting these battles at all.
Plenty of examples of this. You see it with the IRS going after low-income people as opposed
Precisely.
To the high-income people. You see it in the context of Dodd-Frank, where all these lawyers came in and fought the imposition of Dodd-Frank laws. Mark Joseph Stern, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I can't thank you enough.
Thanks so much, Mark, for having me on.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Brian Concannon, who was able to join us last minute notice, actually, Mark as well, both very appreciative of both of them making their time for us today. But just remember these court cases, folks, because we're going to be talking about these cases a lot over the next coming years, because these are the first steps in a series of cases that are going to diminish the ability of our government to protect citizens, to protect citizens as consumers, to protect workers. And there is very little that we can do about it at this point, short of, you know, expanding the Supreme Court, which is, you know, it is a dead idea at this moment anyways. It may pick up steam over the course of the next 3 or 4 years. I don't know, but rather scary. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Brian Kincannon. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report here with Emma Vigeland, and I want to welcome back to the program Brian Kincannon. He is the executive director of Project Blueprint. He's an advisor to the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Brian, we spoke not too long ago. The time escapes me. There was a lot of unrest in Haiti, as there very often is, frankly, and political turmoil because the president at the time, Jovenel Moïse, was, I don't know how you would say it, he was sort of very hesitant to leave. and he was assassinated last night in his home. Set the context for us before we actually go into the assassination itself.
Sure, Sam. When we spoke, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's good to be with you. When we spoke back in March, President Moïse was not only hesitating to leave, he was systematically dismantling Haiti's democracy. And unfortunately, he was doing it with the support of the international community, including the United States. That continued through May, April, May, and June. Things in Haiti had gotten much worse. July was already a month marked by political violence and a year marked by political violence. And this is just the latest of those. It unfortunately puts Haiti in a really tough place. I spoke with a human rights activist this morning and asked how she was doing. And she said, "This is worse than we ever could have imagined." And this is a country that's really suffered an immense amount, and people have pretty good imaginations about, you know, about worst case scenarios. Haiti's now left with a pretty strong power vacuum. The Constitution has a roadmap for how you replace a president, but most of the roads on that map have been closed. You're supposed to have the National Assembly elect a president within 60 days. The National Assembly is like a joint Congress in the United States, where you get the Senate and the House of Representatives together. But almost all the seats in Haiti's legislature, except for 10 senators, are vacant. The Supreme Court can have a role here, but the Supreme Court Chief Justice passed away from COVID last week. Half of the seats on the court are vacant. And so really throughout the government, the type of structures that you would rely on to give you resilience in these times have been dismantled.
So can you talk about how, I mean, just a little bit more background, how the country's, you know, previous president Martelly, he tapped Moïse, and, you know, that was around 2016, 2017, and he had the backing of the Clintons, you know, very aggressively, it seemed. And thus that carried over to Moïse in the Trump administration, and seemingly at least publicly with the Biden administration. So we're still learning information, but it sounds like there was at least one American voice in terms of the mercenaries that attacked him, according to early reports. You know, what role potentially could the U.S. have played in this? Because he, despite dismantling all these democratic institutions, was clearly, you know, a part of the folds of the United States foreign policy apparatus.
That's a really good point, Emma. Haitians connect those same dots. They, when they're talking about what's happening today, they go back to 2010 when Secretary of State Clinton pushed Haiti's Electoral Council to change the results of the elections. So Michel Martelly came in third of those elections, which means which meant he should not have been in the runoff. But Secretary Clinton, under a threat of revoking everybody's U.S. visas, said that they needed to change President or Michel Martelly's place, and they obeyed, and Martelly became president. He did not get there with the support of the Haitian people, so he ran his office as if he had no popular support. He built up a very corrupt political machine to keep himself in power, and the machine was strong enough that he was able to transfer power to President Moïse in an election where fewer than 20% of Haitian registered voters even bothered to participate because they knew a sham when they saw it. Since then, Moïse has continued to consolidate power and as we discussed last March, really been dismantling the structures of accountability. That includes courts, that includes anti-corruption mechanisms, it includes going after journalists, going after lawyers. Really, any voice that could hold the government accountable was suppressed. And unfortunately, the United States was behind that all the way. I mean, going back to President Martelly, we felt that Martelly was someone we could work with. The same with Moïse. And so ever since then, for both administrations, we've been providing generous financial support. We've been providing diplomatic support, making sure that the OAS and the United Nations continue to support both Moïse and Martelly. And so we're in a situation where the United States has supported the gathering of all of Haiti's political parties in the hands of one person. And now that person is dead. And so it really puts Haiti in a tough position. It does provide an opportunity for the United States. I think we can hopefully learn from this experience, and we can support a democratic Haiti, one where we care about processes, where we care about fairness rather than caring about who is in charge. Because one of the things that people are concerned about now is that the U.S. is going to pick a leader, pick someone that the U.S. thinks is the best place to lead Haiti out of this and support that person rather than an inclusive process that will create a legitimate president.
Before we get into, you know, any type of like a sense of who might have done this, and I have to say, like, it is surprising. I mean, there's other examples, but to see an assassination of someone who does have the backing of the United States, right? I mean, history, for the most part, has been when you see an assassination or a coup attempt, and to the extent that there is a great interest in it by the United States, they tend to have involvement on the side of the one doing the killing rather than being killed or being dispossessed or flown out of the country. But before we get to that, what is, reiterate for us, I know we talked about this a bit in March, but what is the U.S. interest in having having this type of hegemony over Haiti? I mean, because it is, there may be a natural desire for the United States to have hegemony over every country, but there is a more acute desire, it seems to me, when it comes to Haiti. That is obviously, and there's a long history of this, but what is it? Is it just, are we just talking about commodities?
Very good question. And you know, you asked that of Jemima Pierre when she was on the show with me, and she gave a wonderful answer that I'll try to recap as best I can. I mean, the basic point is that Haiti has always been a bad example that the U.S. needed to eradicate. That started in 1804 when Haiti was insisting on being a free country and a country born of slaves who freed themselves in a world that was dominated by slave-holding powers, including the United States. So the U.S. would not even recognize Haiti. And Haiti was the second independent country in the Americas. So you would think that we would embrace Haiti with open arms. We did not until just a few weeks after our own Emancipation Proclamation in 1862. That was really what allowed us to at least recognize Haiti. But since then, we've been we've continued to punish Haiti. Haiti is the country that had the longest marine occupation in the hemisphere. We've overthrown several presidents. Haiti's had 33 coup d'etats. The U.S. has been involved in a bunch of them. We supported the Duvalier dictatorship. We supported the dictatorship that ousted President Aristide in 2004. We continue to support Presidents Martelly and Moise. And I think what we're most worried about is that Haiti is going to give us an example of real popular democracy, because that's what Haitians keep insisting on doing, that we have a democracy where the people actually get to choose their policies rather than corporations, rather than foreign interests, rather than economic elites. And that's something that presidents of both parties in the U.S. have apparently found very threatening.
But I mean, I just find it hard to believe that that's that much of a threat, only because the American public certainly has no awareness of these issues, broadly speaking. All due respect to my countrymen, but I mean, surely there has to be specific industries that are really worried about the democracy, because the democracy ends up leading to, like, hey, wait a second, maybe some of the value of these resources should be focused on this country rather than on, you know, corporate interests in some boardroom in New York or in London or wherever it is. Are there specific, is it basically just sugar? Are there other commodities, or are we looking for cheap labor? I mean, or is it a factor of all of those?
You know, I've been working on Haiti now for 26 years, and I've been asking myself that same question, because we're used to thinking in terms of, you know, we invade Iraq for the oil, or we overthrow governments in Central America over bananas. But in Haiti, there really isn't a single economic interest that would explain U.S. foreign policy. Yes, there's some mining. There's a little bit of sugar. There is assembly manufacture. But all of those are really, it comes to that this is a case that we are really worried about ideology, that we just do not want a progressive democracy to succeed. And I think you're right when you said that most Americans know nothing about what's going on in Haiti. I think you can probably say that, unless they're watching your show, about what's going on in the United States in terms of the limits of popular sovereignty and the unlimits of corporate power. And I think that if there really is just a concern that if Haiti is allowed to question the current unequal status quo, that could create, it goes back to Ronald Reagan, right, and the domino effect.
It could create
a domino effect, yes, where other countries could insist on having a popular democracy, which would eventually pose an existential threat to elite rule in the United States.
I am often guilty of forgetting the precedent rule that very often is like, you know, if you let one happen, then other countries start getting the ideas.
All right, which I think ties in well, just quickly, with the support for Guaido by Moise, where he essentially backed the United States' position on recognizing Guaido as the leader of Venezuela, right? I mean, that's part of the calculus here too, right? I didn't mean to cut you off, Sam.
That's a big part, Emma. And that was something that was extremely controversial in Haiti. Haiti kind of has a self-image of being on the side of the oppressed, on the side of progressive principles in international forum. And for President Moise to kind of switch sides on that was shocking throughout Haitian society, that he was doing that basically because the United States wanted to, required him to, and he got the payback. I mean, he felt he needed to do that because he needed U.S. support against his people, and he got it. So it was a deal that, you know, that worked out for him and, you know, for the United States, in the sense that they were able to, you know, continue to gang up on Venezuela.
So, Brian, I mean, do you have a sense of who might be behind this? I mean, it sounds like it's not just a random situation, obviously. I mean, the political assassination of this ilk, and on one hand, it throws the country into all sorts of chaos, which one could imagine it both, you know, gets rid of a guy who was at the very least an aspiring dictator, it seems to me, if not a full-on one. But it also throws the country into chaos and allows for another dictatorial sort of impetus to rise, one that might be more durable and have a reset button. So it seems to me that it could have been, this serves the interests of maybe a wide, disparate number of players.
That's exactly it. It's very hard to tell why this assassination took place. There are many groups with a motive. There are many groups with a capacity to do a hit. Although, you know, people in Haiti are expressing shock that there was not much sign of resistance by President Moïse's security. If in fact that's true, then it was probably to some extent an inside job, and that's what there's a lot of speculation on Haiti. But there's, you know, just lots of people who have lots of guns and who could operate such an attack. So it's hard to say exactly why that happened. In terms of going forward, Haitians are really worried. I spoke with a human rights activist this morning who was a pretty staunch opponent of Moïse. And she said, this is worse than we ever could have imagined. Right. So she's worried about things getting much worse. I think that's a pretty broadly shared view. I think that Haitians, they didn't want President Moïse dead. They wanted him out of office and their democracy alive. And there's, you know, lots of risks of things getting worse. I think there is an opportunity for things to get better. And I think that's an opportunity for U.S. policy. It's an opportunity for Haitian voters. In order for that opportunity to be seized, the international community needs to make a decision. And again, the U.S. will take leadership on this. So if there is going to be support for this, it has to be the U.S. taking the lead. On supporting a process that leads to fair, inclusive, and broadly accepted elections. What the risk is that the U.S. is going to again decide who it thinks can best lead Haiti and put all their support behind him.
Ryan Kincannon, Executive Director of Project Blueprint, Advisor to Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for covering Haiti.
And folks, if you're watching us on Peacock, the Peacock app, we will say goodbye and see you tomorrow. For those of you who are not, oh boy, we have so much show left for you. It's crazy. It is crazy. We're going to head into should we head into the fun half we're going to head into the fun half. We're just going to take a quick break. Coming up, I'm going to welcome to the program Yaron Brook. He is, as far as I know, the chairman of the board at the Ayn Rand Institute. And apparently he was the executive director from 2000 to 2017. So I suspect he's a big fan of Ayn Rand. But we will find out more when we come back. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. Not only do you support the free show when you become a member, you get it commercial free. Although I think we're going to keep the 7E ad in there today.
I love it.
Wait, tomorrow. We're doing that tomorrow. Sorry. And
I'm naming my first child Sebade.
And Sebade. And oh, that's what I should have done. I should have named my child that. And then mm-hmm. I could just talk about it all the time. Not. Mm-hmm.
That's a really creative way to get around the algorithm.
Yeah, probably not so great for the kid long term, yeah. But also, if you become a member, you get the fun half. And boy, we're going to have hopefully some fun today and maybe learn something too when we speak with Yaron Brook. Also, don't forget, Nomi Show now on Tuesdays and Thursdays at youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. And Matt, what's happening in the Leckian media universe? All right, check that out, folks. And we will see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. Oh, really? See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. back, back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back DJ Dennis?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dennis.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total.
We're back now.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Apologize for Matt's sound. I made a decision the other day that sometimes I'm going to randomly censor Matt and not let his sound carry through our devices. And therefore, there will be times where Matt will speak and I have just deemed that he will be canceled. And that is censorship and First Amendment violation. And it's critical Matt theory. Critical Matt studies that we do around here. And
let me just reiterate really quickly tonight, 8 Eastern, Austin of Machete Mate on Left Reckoning, talking about the Americas besides the States.